You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for June 21st, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside Los GOP Demographico Death Spiral, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
And I went to Babel Fish, and in Spanish it's Espiro de la Muerte Demográfica Republicano. And as you said on Twitter, Ted Cruz is Spanish for Frank Burns.
Yeah, he really is. He really, really is. And that's your party, you know. Embrace it, man.
Well, like on an earlier podcast this year, you talked about Ted Cruz as a loose nuke within the Republican Party.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to blow it up, and he doesn't care. So.
No, he is. I was listening, as I often do, Blue Gal, to Rush Limbaugh. Because flying down the road between hither and yon, doing the important work that I do flip around to the stations in the available in the local area, and Rush Limbaugh is on at least two stations simultaneously in my listening area. And yesterday he was, I'm not going to dwell on it, but he was just bitching about, now we have to make the Hispanics happy. And then the gays are going to have to be happy.
And then the chicks. Don't forget the chicks. And,
you know,
they're never happy.
The fegulas and the chicks and the beaners is what he really wants to say. And, you know, we have to give them stuff. And, you know, this is – and it's horrifying to him that he actually – you know, and in normal human society, that's called constituent services.
Yeah.
It's called not insulting the people that you are asking to vote for you for office by treating them like animals or like criminals or like second-class citizens. But Rush doesn't understand that. Or he understands it perfectly well, but his listeners, being the, you know, a vast army of meatheads that they are, he just tells them what they want to hear. What they want to hear is, and he said the critique, the biggest complaint we have about those politicians in Washington is they're not angry enough. They're not like us. They're not angry enough and willing to stand up and take those controversial positions and risk being called extremists. And Ted Cruz is a Rush Limbaugh Republican because Rush Limbaugh runs the Republican Party. There's really nobody else who does it. He and Roger Ailes split the duty.
Well, I've been saying that to several people who've asked questions about what is it the Republican Party? Why are they doing this? And I said the only thing they care about at this point is making Rush Limbaugh and Roger Ailes happy. They have no other purpose.
There is no agenda.
Governing is not on the list of things they have to do. Nope.
Well, and it fits neatly with the idea that the government should dry up and blow away. Yeah. And so if we just destroy it, if we just keep throwing sand into the machinery, eventually it'll seize up and collapse, and we can just rule companies, corporations can just rule directly. I'm not saying they don't get plenty of help from Democrats. I am saying that there is an actual difference between the way, you know, you can, we did this before, go down the list of leaders in the Democratic Party and in the progressive liberal movement, thought leaders, policy people, people who are actually not diddling on the sideline, not, you know, like Josh Barrow, bless his heart, trying to, you know, as I'm stealing also from someone from Twitter, you know, he needs to throw that chicken away and get another one because that chicken's dead. but these sort of handful of fantasy bong hit dorm room real true conservatives who keep pretending that there's underneath the thick veneer of crazy, there's a core of Burkean reasonableness inside the party. Like, no, dude, it's gone. Mm-hmm. It went away. There's nothing there but crazy. As the lady says, it's turtles all the way down, man.
Yep.
Nothing there but that. And they keep trying to find the pony in the pile of shit, and there's nothing there. But those people are you watch them, and those people are being sort of fronted as thought leaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, they're not. Yeah. They live in a dorm room, a virtual dorm room, and they sit around and talk about, wouldn't it be nice if we had a sandwich, if we only had some bread and some meat and some cheese and some other stuff, we'd have a great sandwich. But we don't have any of those things. But wouldn't it be great if we did? But if you look at the Democratic side, you can find people you disagree with and people who are doing a terrible job and people who are, you know, too subordinate to corporate interests. But you can find actual political leaders, policy leaders. You can go, you know, from Al Franken to Harry Reid if you want to. I don't particularly want to include him. But people who actually take an active interest in the acts of government and how government works. Versus, I just want to appease the talk radio host who will probably be my employer someday,
yeah,
or who can turn an army of meatheads against me at the next primary, and that's all I care about. So there is actually a distinction between the two groups, even though you can't see it from space.
We are going to have an abbreviated podcast today because this is our last weekend with kids for several weeks, mm-hmm, and I know I'm really behind on my correspondence to people, and I apologize, but next week I'll be kid free and we'll get some letters out to people.
Sure. Blame the children. Go ahead.
Well, I do. I blame motherhood for that.
Well, and we are literally dashing out the door after we hang this up and making a journey across country.
Yeah.
So we're banging this
out. And we're not going to Netroots Nation. Shout out to everybody who's going to Netroots Nation this weekend. We are visiting family this weekend, with the kids and saying our goodbyes to them. And, as I say, they'll be gone for several weeks this summer with their dad. So,
which is sad.
Oh, well, we'll miss them, but they have a lot of fun.
They do.
Have a lot of fun. So we have three letters to read to you today, and hopefully we'll get through them.
Who will I blame all the farts on, though?
I don't know.
Yeah.
The cats,
yeah, of course.
All right.
Anyway, letters.
Letters. And again, this letter is dated May 5th, and I have not written back to this person to thank him for his contribution yet. I do apologize. This is from Jack, a.k.a. New Grandpa, and thank you for your letter and your contribution, Jack. We appreciate it so much. Driftglass and Blue Gal, I have been listening to the podcast for a couple of months. Even though I am a dog person, not too fond of kitties, and am not a sci-fi fan, I do enjoy it and agree with a lot of what you have to say. Please keep up the good work. In your May 3rd show, you mentioned something that makes a lot of sense that I think we need to keep talking about. With about 40% of the country still believing the right-wing nonsense, advertisers cannot afford to let the media state the obvious. That is the Republican Party's only objective, is to make Obama look bad.
Yeah.
They are on the wrong side of almost every issue and are bereft of any positive policy ideas, but the advertisers need to sell products to the whole country and therefore dictate that news and political commentary be centrist. I think that's a wonderful...
Yeah.
Comment. And that's one of the reasons, too, that marriage equality has changed at the speed of light. I knew that the war was winnable when I saw that American Airlines had a gay travel division.
It changed at the speed of money.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's what color are you? You're green.
Yeah.
You know, so and that is absolutely true.
And one quick aside, since we now occasionally watch Mad Men.
Yes.
And the
finale is this week.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, mm-hmm, when someone is trying to point out to a white owned real world television company whose sales have been flat for a long time that most of their sales are to black people.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a way we can, you know, since you're already appealing to that group and they find your product, you know, useful and valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a campaign we could go forward with that would, you know, improve your standing and they would buy more of them. And the people who own the company looked horrified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't want to be a Negro company.
Yeah.
And it's that's the attitude you got to go after. That's the hinge. It's all of the radio talk shows and all the TV shows are all sponsored. And once the sponsors get it through their head that, oh my God, I'm pissing people off who want to put my kid through college.
Mm-hmm.
I maybe should not do that.
Well, and this whole thing with Cheerios, you know, you can get upset about Cheerios and GMO and all of that, but the mixed race marriage ad that brought a lot of racist comments to YouTube,
uh-huh,
which everyone who is familiar with YouTube commenters,
yes,
could have predicted. They are the bottom feeders of the internet.
Yes.
You know, advertising to mixed race couples. Mixed race children are the future of this country.
Yes, that's what
I'm looking forward. I've said this to you many times.
Uh-huh.
My mocha latte grandchildren. Yes. I'm not even bracing myself for that. I know it's going to happen. So, you know, that's fine.
Well, and this is where we get down to the distinction between the blood and soil conservatives.
Yeah.
It's all about race and property.
Yeah, you know, women are property too. Don't
exactly.
Forget. Yep.
And my grandfather bled for my you know these guys' rights to own slaves. Therefore, it was an honorable cause. No, it wasn't. But the flip side of that is America is an idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's all America ever has been, an idea that is imperfectly implemented, that is betrayed, that is put on the shelf and taken down every now and then. Like, oh crap, we've screwed this up. It's constantly improving, constantly getting better. With a lot of backsliding. And as long as you embrace the idea, no one should give a shit what color you are or what race you are or what ethnicity you are or what religion you are or what your gender is or what your sexual preferences are. None of that is relevant to the idea. And that's where we constantly fall down. It's no, America's not an idea. It's a pie. And if they get some, I lose some.
Right, right.
And we're just wired differently than each other in the end. There's just a place where we can't talk to each other because if you give them something, you're taking away from me. And that 100 years from now, as the saying goes, all new people.
Yeah.
So they'll look back on this and find blogging quaint and journalism embarrassing and wonder what the hell the fuss was about. I hope.
Thank you very much for that letter. I only read a little excerpt of it. It's a great letter, but I did want to get to that point, and that's what we have time for. Thank you so much, Jack, for your letter and your contribution again. All right. Drift Class, there's a letter from Will in Canada.
Oh, you want me to read that?
Would you read that, please?
I'd be happy to, but it's addressed to you.
Do you mind
if I read your mail?
I don't.
Will from Canada says, "Hi, Blue Gal. My name is Will, and I'm a big fan of the Professional Left podcast. But I have been a bad fan for quite some time now and haven't been tuning in like I should. I recently became a Canadian citizen, go Canada, and have been falling in love with my new country, learning her politics and participating in my first election a few weeks ago. And honestly, my country of birth has had so many problems lately, I think I was overwhelmed and just turned it all off. But now, like a switch, I've turned back on and re-engaged. Why? The business of the U.S. government forcing phone companies to surrender their data. I wanted to share a few observations with you and get your opinion. One, I've come to realize that there is no such thing, in all capital letters, as internet privacy. That all caps thing must be a Canadian thing. none. It can't be done. If you want true privacy, you have to stay off the web, and good luck with that in a modern society. By the way, hello, NSA, since I'm sure this email is being flagged by keywords. Number two, I would argue this phone data collection is similar to my thoughts about the U.S. torture doctrine. Where is the hard science that proves it works? The Boston bombers were already on a watch list, and that tragedy wasn't stopped. Why all the spying? Does it work? Show me. All very reasonable questions. Number three, what with all this data being collected and restored, how long is it before an email like this is flagged, reviewed, and if Big Brother doesn't like what I have to say, I get reprimanded or worse? In other words, now that Pandora's box was opened by the Patriot Act and the box just seems to be opening wider and wider, where does this stop? Number four, last point. Isn't a government that spies on its own citizens who haven't been accused of doing anything wrong the definition of a police state? All great points.
Mm-hmm.
So, Blue Gal, once again, I apologize for being a negligent fan. I feel the need to tell you that you and Drift Class are appreciated and your opinions matter to many people. Also, I have so much respect for the people that take the time to put their thoughts, ideas, and art out there into the world. That takes guts and should be respected. Have a great weekend."
Thank you.
Yeah.
We like to think of it as we're kind of gutsy.
Yeah.
I want you to tell the story of going to get your watch fixed yesterday and going to the P.O. box first.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. That's a charming story. So because I'm nuts and have constant internal monologues with myself and test, you know, reality by poking at it every now and then. So I'm off to the post office box yesterday because yesterday a whole bunch of things happened. There was my car had one more flat tire. This is like the second or third in a month. My stepdaughter's bike had a flat tire. My watch, both the battery stopped and the watch band broke. And I love my watch. It's just the right weight and it fits good on my arm and I love my watch. So I'm tooling around town doing some work and running some errands and doing the things I do. And I went to the P.O. box and I said, you know what? Things have been going kind of balanced out pretty well. You know, things are good, things are bad, things are up, things are down. I'll bet that I'll open the P.O. box and whatever comes out of the envelope will be enough to pay for my watch repair. And that's sort of how, you know, we're living. It's sort of like this is enough to get through. And that's
that is always my prayer is, you know, sufficient to the need.
Yes.
That's all we need in the P.O. box is pay for today.
Mm-hmm. So
far, so good.
So I'm like, OK. And I open it up and nothing in there. Empty P.O. box. I stick my very long arm all the way in and try to grab the post. He's like, get back, you bastard. So I'm like, OK, well, that didn't work out. So I go to the watch repair place because it's a small town. Well, it's a medium sized town, but it's small compared to where I used to be. And I go in and walk over to the counter and the guy hands me my watch and says, no charge. What? Yeah, it says no charge. Don't worry about it. OK. And I shook his hand and asked for if there's something I can do in the future, please let me know and I'll buy him a beer someday. And it was just, you know, because it was a minor thing and they lost the ticket, and I think they inconvenienced me just a little bit.
Yeah, they did. They had to call you back a couple times to find your watch. So I think.
Yeah, and I think they just, and it was a small thing, but it was just a really nice gesture, really nice touch.
And it was sufficient to the
need. It absolutely was.
Nothing. Box had just enough.
Zero was just enough. So yeah.
I like that story.
It's a nice little story, and it has the additional virtue of being true.
Of being true.
Uh huh.
Right, so now we're going to read Lawrence in Phoenix, who wrote us this story. It's a short story.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked really hard on this. I have to say, I'm really impressed. So thank you, Lawrence, mm-hmm. for writing to us. And I'll start.
Let me just finish off the previous letter.
Oh, okay.
Because Will did ask for our reaction. And I think they're great questions. I think they're wonderful questions. I think, isn't a government that spies on its own citizens who haven't been accused of doing anything wrong, and the definition of a police state. I don't mean to get all Clintonian, but I really do think that depends on what you believe spying looks like. Mm. When you send your taxes in to the government and they put all of your income and your address and your social security, which, by the way, the government issues to you, mm-hmm. and was never supposed to be used as an ID ever. In fact, that was the initial promise. This would never be a national ID number. And now it is. Mm-hmm. When you go to the DMV, when you do anything else that involves interacting with, when you go to get a business license, when you get your trash hauled, mm-hmm. Pretty much anything else, you have to give
the
government.
When you rent a moving truck. I mean, my ex-husband just hit the ceiling when they wanted his social security number. Cell phone, they want your social, and they will run a credit check on you, even if you aren't renting out the cell phone, even if it's not in your name. It's amazing.
Now you might... It is perfectly legitimate to think of all of that as spying.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Heinlein basically used to write that the reason space travel would be great is you could get the hell away from a society where a handshake wasn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
That any society that demanded you carry ID is one you should immediately leave, because that's become a bureaucratic police state kind of thing. So there's a perfectly legitimate argument to be made that any collection of any data on any citizens by a central authority beyond a handshake and my word is good enough because you know who I am and I'm your neighbor is intrusive and meddling and possibly spying. But there is a distinction between collecting contact phone information, phone number, where from, where to, and duration, without names, without addresses, without any sort of context, your phone bill, and listening to your phone calls. So, I think that is the place where we should be having this conversation. What is the limit? And most importantly, very good point, does it work? I personally don't care if torture works. We should never torture anybody ever, period.
Right.
I don't care. That's a line I just personally, as an American, cannot cross. And maybe it makes me a hypocrite to say collecting to and from packet switching information off of a phone call doesn't bother me as much. Maybe that makes me a terrible person. I know some people think it does. But that is the place where we should be having a conversation. And the best way to have that conversation is not to kick each other's teeth out for disagreeing honestly over where the line should be drawn and what should be done. And I completely agree that the proof of it, does this work? And is it worth the trade-off, is the conversation we should be having out in the open. So,
well, and also, as I said last week, this kind of data is really new in the grand scheme of history.
Yeah.
We forget that. We forget that when you and I got married 2 years ago, there weren't as many smartphones out there as there are today. You know, and that when we started blogging, there were no smartphones. There was no Twitter.
Yeah. There was no YouTube.
There was no YouTube right away. That came on board pretty quickly after we started blogging. But yeah, you couldn't embed. I had to teach myself how to embed a video. That was a big deal.
It was.
I remember 2007 when the Obama campaign had embeddable code of Barack Obama's speech in Selma.
Uh-huh.
And the code worked. And when I went to my blog and posted it, and it worked on my Blogger blog, I said, this guy could win.
Yeah.
Because he had technology on his side. Wow. He can get his speeches out there via bloggers.
And wiretapping.
And it wasn't YouTube. At that point, he was using a private company to embed with embeddable code for his videos. It was
amazing.
A big deal.
And now it's
everybody has a smartphone with a GPS where you can locate the phone and you can find my phone and on and on. And all that is really new, and the law has to catch up. It does.
And we have to
decide as a citizenry rather than the telecom companies and big government. It's up to us to advocate for what we want.
And this picture, and I'm exaggerating just slightly, but this picture of your boyfriend or girlfriend at Yosemite is not a picture of your boyfriend. It is a digital image with location and time code potentially embedded in it.
Right.
That lets people who know what they're doing look at where you are, what you were doing, and tag the face.
People that steal cell phones and take pictures of themselves with it, and of course they're right immediately in the cloud.
Yeah.
Their picture is in the cloud as a cell phone thief.
But even the term wiretapping.
Yeah.
Doesn't work anymore.
Old fashioned. Yeah. There's no wire involved. Yeah.
When Harlan Ellison went out, as I said last week, and found the guys up on the wires in the utility truck.
They were tapping his phone with the
physically.
Wires. Yes.
And he said, so what are you doing up there? Nothing. Are you tapping my phone? And he had people come out to his house. He had experts, surveillance experts, come out. And at that time, there was a thing he described as a drain on the line.
Mm-hmm.
The actual electricity coming down the line would be interfered with and bled away from. And he said, oh, yeah, the drain on this line is enough to light up the whole town. You've got a whole bunch of taps on this line. This is when Ronald Reagan, Governor Reagan, was physically tapping the phones of his enemies.
Political enemies, yeah.
In California.
Yeah.
And the very phrase wiretapping is no longer happens on a wire and is no longer a tap. Mm-hmm. It could be email. And this is where the conversation, I'll just leave it here, confuses me. Not through anyone's malice, but when the technical person like Mr. Snowden talks about what's going on, if I were the reporter, I'd stop and ask really simple, dumb questions. Like, when you say wiretapping, do you mean telephone audio conversations? Mm-hmm. Do you mean email contents? When you say you can do something, do you do that thing?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the cop on the street with a gun in his holster can shoot me. But he doesn't. And the fact that you have the technical capacity to do a thing, cops have the ability to tap your phones right now. Doesn't mean they're doing it. It means that if they get a court order, they can proceed with that. And those, anyway, I'm not saying anyone's right or wrong or questioning anyone's motives at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that those are really good questions that should be asked by the primary reporter of the story to find out the difference between policy and what some rogue person could be doing. And what you'd mean when you say, I hate to get, again, Clintonian, what does is mean? What does spy mean?
No, that's my point, is I think a lot of people out there, and I'm sure there's been science fiction stories written about this.
Yes.
But a lot of the powers that be out there are simply taking advantage of our addiction to these technologies.
Yes.
And if you have a choice between, you know, anyone can track you if you have this smartphone in your pocket. Maybe you want to give that up. Oh, no, I can't live without my phone. You know, that's and well, isn't, we are really addicted to these technologies.
Isn't what part of the passage?
Yeah.
The story, people gave up their cell phones.
That was one of the first things that happens in the passage. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they didn't want to be tracked.
They didn't want to be tracked by. Yeah.
And your cell phone is a tracking device. Whether or not somebody flips the switch on that tracking device, it's there.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to find out.
It's the FBI agent. The FBI agent in who should be played by Tom Hanks in the movie. I'm just going to say so. He throws away his cell phone. Yeah. Because he knows that they will find him. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Let's read this story from Lawrence.
Yeah.
All right. Here we go. First day of instruction, Yale University, fall semester a few years from now. Slouching undergrads looked briefly away from the Facebook window on their 5mm thick tablets, running either Mac OS Liger or Windows Ennui to circulate the unexpected piece of paper. Most sections had a share site for course documents. The page was titled Humility. A small man in glasses wearing a patch-sleeved tweed jacket that is the uniform of the humanities professor welcomed the students and began taking roll. He didn't introduce himself. Everyone knew who he was, or ought to. His soft, almost lisping voice read their names. Mr. Astor, here. Ms. Cabot, here. Mr. Eastman, here. Mr. Electrico?
David fucking Brooks. We meet at last.
The voice from the dimly lit top tier of the lecture hall rolled across the room. You, Brooks stammered, panic-stricken. You're that guy from the internet. You can't be here.
It is I, Brooks. Broder's Bane. The centrist cleaver. Hammer of the left blogosphere. I am Driftglass, and I have come for you.
I thought you would be taller.
I'm still sitting down, asshole.
Driftglass rose up to his full height, threw back the hood of his dark gray robe. Huh? It looked like a sweatshirt when he was sitting. The hulking apparition marched down the steps with deliberate menace. Light bled from the room, and Brooks' vision drew to a tunnel. With Driftglass still halfway up the lecture hall, Brooks rallied himself. I'm not alone here, you know.
These lacrosse-playing douchebags won't help you.
Fool! I can summon a legion of elite freedmen units.
You know how you are always saying that I have armies of Obots to do my bidding? Today I do. My Obots routed those mustachioed clone clowns. As we speak, they lay to spoil the fallen for their trophies.
Driftglass, now approaching the dais, ignited a lightsaber with an emerald green blade of prodigious length.
It's over, Brooks. I will restore balance to the media. You will turn or meet your doom.
I do not take orders from a hippie, Brooks snarled through bared teeth. His hands came up, clawing the air. Lurid arcs of electricity lashed from his fingers. Driftglass parried the assault with his blade, advancing on Brooks.
Old Tom Fury won't be having any of that, Brooks,
he grated.
You'll have to do better.
But Brooks was growing pale and short of breath. His spark went out as he fell to his knees. But the liberals, I have grown weak in the way of centrism. How is this possible? He struggled to his feet, catching his breath. Straightening his glasses, he looked at Driftglass. What have you done?
Broderick can no longer help you. I had him exhumed. A Unitarian minister performed an exorcism on the body, the only occasion that faith has ever had for such a ritual. I then cremated him on a bough of hemp. The power of Broder is ended for all time.
Liberal bastard! Brooks clenched his fists and thrust forth his chin. How dare you! Even if you defeat me, others will avenge me. Sullivan and Greenwald, he fought you in the drone wars.
Silence!
Driftglass bellowed. The room began to tremble. A rolling office chair shot across the dais, taking out Brooks' legs. Simultaneously, a well-stuffed and tastefully weathered soft leather briefcase struck him in the face, knocking him back into the chair. Chalkboard erasers banged against Brooks' head, exhaling choking dust. Driftglass dropped the items and stood over the wheezing Brooks.
The age you speak of is not coming. Not 3 weeks ago, Sullivan watched as the traitor Darth Greenwald fell under my sword. Sullivan threw himself upon my mercy. Between knitting lessons and scooping the cat boxes, Blue Gal makes him read A People's History of the United States. He may one day prove worthy of becoming her Padawan. Such is my offer to you. Turn or be destroyed.
Brooks pressed his hands against his temples. He squeezed his eyes shut to stop the room from spinning. His world was ending. But then he opened his eyes, which were now a ghastly yellow. He stood, gaining stature and radiating cold malice. "You are mistaken, Blogger, about a great many things. I am rich. I am the establishment. I frame the entire conversation. I don't need Broder. I am a more powerful in the ways of centrism than he ever was. In fact, I have gone beyond centrism. I no longer have need of both sides. I live in a $4 million house. I get paid a fortune to write 800 words a week. I get paid again to show up at Yale and bloviate to these resume-padding trust fund babies. And they show up and act like it matters, like I matter. All these years you have fought me over both sides, and what did it get you? Page hits? Ha! So I will confess to you at last. Isn't that what you always wanted? Both sides are not to blame, but one side, yes, my deluded Blogger, one side has money and power, unlimited power. Now you will pay the price for your lack of vision. Now you will die. Brooks' soul let go of centrism, and guided by his unshakable sense of privilege and yearning for status, plunged into the raw, unfiltered rage of the right. A torrent of red lightning erupted from his hands, smashing against Driftglass's blade. Driftglass was knocked back by the force of the attack. Brooks cackled and capered. Conservatism today, conservatism tomorrow, conservatism forever. But Brooks did not notice the fire crawling back up his fingers, blackening his hands and wrists. Brooks was at heart a weakling and a coward. By letting go of centrism and grasping the raw hate of the right, he tapped into a power source far exceeding the carrying capacity of his tender flesh. Driftglass advanced, pushing back against the onslaught. Brooks immolated with a flash and concussive whoomp that blew out the windows and cracked most of the tablet screens. Nothing remained of the late professor of humility but a stain of sulfurous ash where he stood. Driftglass deactivated his lightsaber and holstered it. "Will this be on the test?" asked a girl in the second row, who was wearing a Lilith Fair t-shirt.
"Will what be on the test?"
responded Driftglass. "Midterm? Final? We didn't even get through attendance before whatever that was happened. I traded having a childhood for being here, so I think that's a legitimate question."
"Well, I suppose that will be up to the university. I'll give you an assignment, though. Find a working computer and look up a man named Steve Gilliard. Read a bit of what he had to say. Do you more good than anything you were going to learn here."
With that, Driftglass put his hood up and walked out into the pleasant morning air. That was very good.
Thank you, Lawrence and Phoenix.
Thank you, Lawrence. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is McKittens. I guess that's like McLovin. Our friend from Deep Shag Records sent him in. And see if you can find the Harlan Ellison book in the photo. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions! Letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties are getting real tired of their unpaid internship gig.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Fantastic. Welcome to Science Fiction University.
And these questions were given by a science fiction writer named Robert J. Sawyer. He is a Hugo and Nebula Award winner. He's the author of Red Planet Blues. And I asked him on Twitter if we could use these questions. He had them at a bookstore trivia night or something. So he used them there. So they're a little more I don't want to say pedestrian, but they're mostly regarding movies or pop science fiction that a lot of people would know because it was for public consumption.
All right.
So
what we're trying to do is up my average here since I'm batting.
Well, yeah. And I'm not keeping any score. I know you're not doing great, but I don't care.
I think I'm doing slightly over 500. Which
all right. Well,
for an alleged expert on science fiction is terrible.
No, I just noticed that Shock on Twitter was pretending that you weren't doing that well.
But for a batting average in the
in the major leagues,
in the majors is
great.
It's great. Screw you, Ted Williams. So anyway, fire away.
All right. So, and some of these are very easy.
Good.
Number one, who provided the voice of Darth Vader in the first Star Wars film? And which Muscle Man actor was inside the Vader suit?
James Earl Jones.
Yes.
And Andre the Giant.
David Prowse.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The Empire relied on little one-person ships called TIE Fighters.
Yes.
What does TIE stand for, and what distinguishes Darth Vader's personal TIE fighter from all the others?
I think we did this already.
No, we didn't. I asked you that question because I didn't know it in the bedroom.
Yes, during our naughty talk time.
Our naughty talk. Pillow talk is always, do you know this science fiction question? I'm going to ask you questions just based on Star Trek, the animated series.
I don't know what TIE, I believe it says something to do with the propulsion system and the way that wings are oriented. And Vader's is his panels or his power source or his wings are, they're not really wings because they're in space, are curved as opposed to X'd.
Yep. It's the twin ion engine. That's what TIE fighter stands for.
Uh-huh.
Vader's solar panels bend in toward the central hull. Yes. So you're close enough. The number one best-selling 20th century science fiction novel has been filmed twice. What's its title and who wrote it?
Oh, wow. What a good question. So Back to the Future is out. The number one best-selling 20th century science fiction. I'd have to guess Dune.
You would be right. That's a good guess.
And it was done once.
No, you don't have to know when it was done. You just have to know the author, which I know you know.
Oh, Frank Herbert. It was done once as a miniseries, and it was a really, really good miniseries with very little special effects with, I can't even name any of the
actors. Kyle MacLachlan.
No, that was the movie. Kyle MacLachlan.
That was the movie. Okay.
Yeah. Patrick Stewart, Kyle MacLachlan. It was like filmed and then cut way the hell down. So it was blocky and didn't make any sense. Although it did feature Jose Ferrer, Miguel Ferrer's dad, as the emperor, as I recall. And I should know the director's name. If you give me the first name, I'll get the last one.
Okay, I don't know. It doesn't say that here.
Oh, did you want... Okay, never mind then. So I get that one right. Yay for me. Good for me.
Number four. What is Captain Kirk's brother's name?
Sam.
Very good.
I Am is his middle name, actually. So.
George Samuel Kirk, known as Sam.
Uh-huh.
In his one brief on-screen appearance, who played him? Ooh, that's a good one.
Andre the Giant?
No, you're going to stick with that Andre the Giant.
I'm sticking to that one. Who was it?
It was in the episode Operation Annihilate.
Yeah, I remember him making an appearance. Was it George Pappard?
It was Shatner himself.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that
either. So yeah. There you go.
Yeah, you flip that toupee around, you're a whole different person.
All right. In which of the Star Trek motion pictures did we learn that Kirk's middle name is Tiberius? And I will add that I had to research this to make sure it was really true. Tiberius is, as his middle name, is never mentioned in the original series. I did not know that. I just always thought that we all knew his middle name was Tiberius. But
in which of the Star Trek movies did we learn this?
Right. And which Canadian actor revealed that?
Well, that
this
was
really hard.
It is. Well, that was actually revealed in... I'm going to cheat. Okay. I'm going to totally friggin' cheat and say it was revealed in the new J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie, which is a prequel to the Star Trek movie. Therefore, it precedes all the Star Trek movies. And it's when James T. Kirk is being named by his mommy as he escapes from the ship. And his...
Well, that is true. They do mention Tiberius.
Aha! I win!
Episode. No.
No, screw it.
Because it's also mentioned in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Mm-hmm.
And the Canadian... Do you know the Canadian actor who reveals it?
Or... I think it's either Andre the Giant or George Pappard. No?
No. Christopher Plummer.
Oh, Christopher. That makes perfect sense. Yeah, he's the...
General Chang.
That slipped the dogs of war.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, he did a good job. You know, he chewed up that scenery real good.
All right, here's a Battlestar Galactica question. It turns out Galactica isn't the last surviving Battlestar after all. Mm-hmm. What's the name of the other Battlestar?
Oh, that's a good question, and I should know that. The Admiral on that one is the same woman who played what's-her-name on Star Trek The Next Generation. It's Michelle something or other.
Michelle Forbes, very good, because that's the question. Who played its captain in the new series? It's Michelle Forbes. You got her first name right. That's half a point.
It's the intrepid. I'm mixing it up completely. I don't know. I actually, it's on the tip of my tongue. Give me an hour to think about it, but I don't know.
Yeah, you'll come up with it in the middle of the night during
Defiance,
the time. At just the right moment in bed, you'll yell out, Pegasus!
Pegasus, that's right. It's the Pegasus. The Pegasus. And she and number six were lovers.
Oh.
So not to spoil anything for anyone, but yeah.
Who played that Michelle Forbes character in the original series?
This I actually know, which is really sad, is Lloyd Bridges.
That's right.
Yeah.
Good. All right.
It was a terrible series, too. I mean, Harlan Ellison named it Battlestar Ponderosa because
it was.
Lauren Green posing in a cape for, you know, over and over again. But they actually took chunks of the plot, you know, the arc of that whole story and made it into something worth watching.
Yeah.
Very impressive.
All right. In Star Trek Enterprise, the Enterprise was the first ever human-built Warp 5-capable starship. What was its serial number?
I have no idea.
NX-01.
Okay.
What was the second ship called? It wasn't the Enterprise 2. It was something else, you know?
The Picard, I believe. The USS Picard?
It was the Columbia.
Okay.
And its number was NX-02. All right.
I stopped watching Enterprise after it got to be too jut-jawed for me.
Yeah.
And as I recall, the enemies were that sounded suspiciously like the Taliban. A shape-shifting internal enemy that could destroy us all. It was a good effort, but I just didn't like it at all. So I didn't pay any attention to it.
All right. Number 8. On Star Trek, Spock was half-human and half-Vulcan.
Yes.
What was his father's name?
Sarek.
Yes. And what was his mother's name?
Picard.
Amanda.
Amanda.
You should know that. That's my mother's name.
I should. And it was the same in the movie and the TV series.
Yes, it was.
I should know that.
Yeah. And do you know what his half-brother's name was?
Andre.
Cybok. Number 9. This is an easy... The first one is easy.
Uh-huh.
What was the computer called in the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey?
HAL.
Right. And what was the longer name? Do you know?
Heuristically Programmed Algorithmic Computer.
Yes. And it was 9000, the HAL 9000.
And what was HAL's brother's name on Earth? Ha ha!
HAL's brother's name on Earth was Andre.
No, but you're awfully close. It was Sal.
Oh.
It was serially programmed algorithmic.
Oh, okay. Right.
Or sequentially programmed. It was a different one. And where was HAL built and when?
Boy, you know a lot about HAL. I'm just asking you questions off this sheet here.
It was built in Urbana, Illinois.
Oh, neat.
I think 1999 was the year HAL went live in the manufacturing plant in Urbana, Illinois, which I always thought was a really elegant touch. You know,
that is.
It's like putting Starship manufacturing in Iowa.
Yeah,
it really
which you would do.
It's a good touch.
Mm-hmm. Which Canadian actor provided HAL's voice?
Dick Tufeld.
Douglas Rain.
Okay.
And finally, what song does this computer sing?
Oh, Daisy.
Daisy Bell.
Mm-hmm. Give me your answer. And I've used that trope many times. It's such a heartbreaking and wonderful scene. I never thought, you know, it really makes you feel sorry for this thing that's being killed.
Do you want me to ask you questions from the Star Wars prequels?
No. Well, you can, but I will just laugh at you.
Yeah.
And why did HAL, according to 2010, why did HAL go mad? That was one of those unanswered questions at the very end. And it should have, in my opinion, should have been left unanswered, because there were a lot of mysterious things happening at the end of 2001.
Yeah, there were.
It should have been left there. It should not have been answered. It was a perfectly wonderful ending. But the reason HAL went mad is he was being asked to lie.
Yeah.
And he couldn't make that.
I can't do that. I can't do that, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, the Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, is the answer to number 10.
Yeah.
But I do like the line from this movie.
Uh-huh.
The question is, in what film do we hear the line, "So this is how liberty dies to thunderous applause"?
Yes.
And Princess Amidala says that
mm-hmm.
as Senator Palpatine expands his political power.
Yes.
All right. The most famous split infinitive in history is "to boldly go."
Yeah.
It was originally followed by the words "where no man has gone before."
Uh-huh.
When was that changed to "where no one has gone before"?
I'm guessing it was Star Trek The Next Generation.
That's right.
But it could have been Star Trek The Animated Series.
No, it wasn't. It was Next Gen. And who first said the new version?
Spock.
No, it was Picard.
Picard. Well, yeah, Picard did all the voiceover for that.
When do we hear Leonard Nimoy say the to boldly go speech? When do we hear Leonard Nimoy say the to boldly go speech? And I remember this.
Star Trek 2.
You cry. Yes.
Star Trek 2.
That's right. Wrath of Khan. When he's after death.
Oh, he's not dead. And that's frankly, if you want to mess up a series, this is what people learned from Star Trek, that the takeaway lesson, if you want to elevate your often perfectly good cliche genre fiction into mm-hmm. high art, you have to off main characters. You mm-hmm. cannot keep you can't keep reassuring audiences that the same six main characters you see at the top of the hour will be there at the bottom of the hour or next week or next month or next year. I know it makes it reassuring and comforting. There's nothing wrong with that. But you got to have a friggin' Red Wedding.
Game of Thrones reference.
Somewhere.
Everybody take a drink.
Everyone take a drink of mead. You got to have one of those or else your series is too safe and it's too predictable.
Yeah. All right. When do we hear William Shatner correct it from "where no man has gone before" to "where no one has gone before"? It is at the end of Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. Yeah. Okay. And I remember the one Star Trek convention I attended.
Yeah.
Gene Roddenberry was the headliner.
Yeah.
And he was gearing up for Next Generation, and he bragged about, "We are going to finally say where no one has gone before." And, of course, all the geek girls all went, "Oh, yeah." All right.
Oh, I remember one brief anecdote Mr. Ellison tells about being the speaker. Mm-hmm. He's been a speaker at a million conventions with us at this convention, and he said he got up to speak, and I think he insulted some guy in his audience or – He sized him up really well as, "This is the weekend you've got the kid, and you took him here," you know, whatever it was. But he said he got up, and it was one of those ballrooms where you have a huge room that has accordion doors that opens up into a bigger room mm-hmm. that opens up a bigger room, and by the back it's just little cartoon O's. You can't see anything.
Yeah.
And he thought, "Yeah, I'll do this thing at 8 a.m. I'm here already. I might as well knock it out." And showed up, and it was this monstrous crowd, and he couldn't imagine that they were there to see him, and they were all there to see Shatner.
Oh
yeah, who's this little guy up on the stage? Bring on Shatner. So it's a thing. You it's can't deny thing. It's a thing. No. It made Galaxy Quest an award winner when it should have lost to
Matrix.
But
okay, number 12. Who are Sy Snooties, Max Rebo, and Droopy McCool? And who gets killed while those characters are present?
I have no idea.
They are the members of the band in Star Wars Return of the Jedi.
Oh.
I would never know that. Oh. And I'm proud of myself for not knowing that.
It was in the novel. Yeah, screw you. I'm not reading the novelization of anything.
Nope. And Ula, the slave girl, was murdered by... Yeah, okay.
It's tragic.
All right. Now, this one is the answer is a little bit controversial. I need to let you know.
Okay.
The answer to this one. Well, we'll see how you answer it and then we'll do it. Name the big budget film based loosely on Isaac Asimov's Robot series.
I, Robot with Will.
Good. Okay. So you're answering it that way.
Very, very, very loosely.
Yeah.
Like it had the same title and a couple of characters.
Give the character name of the female robo-psychologist who appears in the robot stories.
I want to say Elijah Bailey, but that's not it.
Susan Calvin.
Susan Calvin. Thank you. Yes, yes.
Do you know who played her in the movie version?
A brunette.
Bridget Moynihan.
Yeah.
Now, some people argued with Robert Sawyer on this and said that Bicentennial Man.
Yeah.
He said, "I'd argue that Bicentennial Man isn't based on Asimov's robot series, but rather actually only on one story."
That's right. Called The Bicentennial Man.
Right. Well, and they also lift heavily from Robot Dreams as well.
Yeah.
But I would have allowed that answer in addition to iRobot.
And so, who played the robot in Bicentennial Man?
Robin Williams.
Yes, he did.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Number 14. On what planet does Luke Skywalker meet Yoda?
Dagobah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Who provides the voice of Yoda?
Mm-hmm. Frank Oz.
And this question is a little far-fetched.
Uh-huh.
What other famous space traveler, ahem, did Frank Oz provide the voice for? I'm sorry. I think it's calling her a famous space traveler is a little bit much.
I don't know.
Miss Piggy.
Miss Piggy.
Because she was in Pigs in Space.
But do you know what Dagobah means?
No.
Oh.
What does Dagobah mean?
I'm quite possibly getting this wrong and mixing up my religions, but I believe it is a temple built in the Buddhist faith, possibly,
okay,
to honor a holy site or a holy relic or a religious area of some kind. I could be entirely wrong about that, but I'm probably not.
Okay, last one. Mm-hmm. On Star Trek, what starship was commanded by Commodore Decker?
Matt Decker?
Yeah. Oh, you know his first name. That was another question I had.
That damn Matt Decker?
Yeah.
It was one of the standard issues, the Defiant, the Intrepid, the...
Constellation. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you answered the question, what is Commodore Decker's first name?
Matt. Goddamn Matt Decker, yeah.
And what is Captain Decker's first name? I don't know who Captain Decker is, but...
Double.
It's, Susan. Starship commanded by Captain Decker is Will.
Will Decker.
Will Decker.
Double Decker,
okay.
I tell you.
Double Decker, okay.
It's the
Thank
fucking
you, Robert Sawyer, with those...
You know what's killing
2006
Starfleet?
Science fiction questions.
You know what's killing Starfleet, honey?
What?
The fucking nepotism. That's what it is. It's who
now,
you know.
These are online, by the way.
It's who you know at Starfleet that gets you ahead. It's not what you know.
These questions are at his website, which is www.sfwriter.com. And so there you go.
I hope I pulled my average up to a gentleman's C at least.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, baby. Love you.